When we started finding this drug online, we hit the FDA journalism. We're trying to think who we could bring in as outside voices. And Deborah said to me, "What about that fellow with the ombudsman for the vote?" And I said, "Yeah, that was really very good." So I called Mark Kirkwood. We had a whole discussion in which he attempted to persuade me he wasn't the ideal person. I went back and read his columns and said, no, you're really the person that we want. Full court press, and I'm very, very glad that we were able to get it. And thank you very much for coming in with us further ado.
Well, very nice day, so I appreciate the fact that you all are kind of a constant captive audience. Let me just tell you a little bit about what I did and do in journalism, and then hopefully address some of the rabbi's concerns and try and make this something of a two-way conversation about journalistic ethics, at least from the journalism side and point of view. I actually am now the associate director of something called the Project for Excellence in Journalism down in Washington, D.C. It's a nonpartisan think tank that actually scrutinizes the behavior of the media, mostly through content analysis. As you probably know, there are media critics on the left, there are media critics on the right, there are media critics who gather around various, very specific issues. We don't have a dog in the fight. What we actually do is, through coding and empirical methods, we actually examine the behavior of the mainstream media and report on it. We examine about 70,000 news stories every year, and we can tell you a lot about them. Before that, I was, for 20 years in Boston, a media critic and an ombudsman. I spent about 10 of those years writing the Don't Quote Me column for the Boston Phoenix, which is an old, for those of you who are from New York, it's the old kind of Village Voice press clips column up here. A column of media criticism that would evaluate the performance of the media. It was very opinion-centric. There was a lot of journalistic license involved. A lot of, I think, sort of who died made me king, but it was a great job. And for 10 years, roughly 10 years at the Boston Globe, I was two things. I was the paper's first ever full-time media beat writer. And secondly, I was the ombudsman. Now, I should say something very quickly about the ombudsman. There are about 1,400 daily newspapers in America. There are about 30 or 40 ombudsmen. And that's no secret as to why that is. It is, in many respects, a very thankless job. There are two things. There's a complaint department, which is basically listening. When I was there in the 90s, it was much more listening to phone calls. Now it's probably much more reading emails. But listening to people complain about the newspaper, and occasionally say nice things, but human nature being what it is, about 99% of the feedback were complaints. The other part of it is, so you're the complaint department, the other part is you're the internal affairs cop. As the ombudsman of the newspaper, you were the only person there who was paid to essentially publicly critique the performance of your own newspaper in the form of a twice monthly column that you would write that would basically take an issue that the readers brought up that you thought was worthy. You would then investigate what happened. Usually it was about something that had gone wrong. And after you had done the reporting, you would then in your own mind decide, was the paper guilty as charged? Was the paper innocent of charges? Or was it somewhere in the middle? And what that frankly meant was that you also began, not only were you often criticizing the work of your superiors, and there was a real, to the credit of the Boston Globe, the editor of the newspaper would read my column, which was often critical of decisions he made, and occasionally he would hand it back to me very grumpily, but he was never allowed to alter a single word of it. And you would often sometimes have to, frankly, critique the performance of your colleagues and your friends and the people who were working at the newspaper. And the practical impact of that was that you had fewer and fewer people who would have lunch with you. There were several people at the Globe who stopped talking to me as a result. And I should say that ombudsman columns are written not in, you know, kind of a dagger, you know, machine gun style. They are written judiciously. They are written carefully. Criticism is given, but it is not it is given sort of in a skillful and judicious fashion. So you weren't out there to rip your colleagues. You were simply out there to reprimand them carefully. But there were at least two people who never spoke to me after I wrote columns to the Globe about them. That's slightly wrong. One didn't never spoke to me. One did speak to me again, but the only words he used were the four letters were right. He would literally see me walking down the hall and begin to scream things that I can't repeat, certainly in this day. So I've had in my basically 25-year career in journalism, I've been focused largely on this strange little part of the profession that's all about ethics. And I've actually been, most of my career has been based on scrutinizing my own profession rather than reporting about other things. I've actually reported on my own profession. And I should say, given this thing, I will tell you my favorite story about Buzzer before I go any further, which is that one of the issues that you might imagine, or you could imagine, that would often provoke tremendous passion among readers and lots of complaints to the Globe was the situation in the Middle East, and particularly during the Second Intifada when the action had heated up. And depending on what was depicted on page one and who was shown and which casualties were shown in the photograph, you would often get an outpouring of anger from people accusing the Globe of anti-Israel bias, occasionally anti-Palestinian bias, and more frequently anti-Israel bias. And one caller used to always call up, and she was a woman, and she never spoke to me directly. She would always leave a message on the voicemail machine. And it was always, I am angered and dismayed today at page one of the Boston Globe, where once again, the Globe depicts the Palestinians as nothing other than victims in the struggle, and the anti-Israeli bias is clear, and every message would be of that sort. There were dozens of them over the course of the years that I covered this and worked on it. And then one day I picked up the phone and I heard her voice and immediately went into default, you know, okay, I know what this is going to be about. And she actually said, I'm here today to praise the Boston Globe, the first time I had ever heard those words out of her mouth, for the story you did on the terrible accident on Melnia Cass Boulevard. What had happened was, a cab driver, a cab carrying a passenger, someone had thrown a rock through the window of a cab on Melnia Cass Boulevard, severely injuring a passenger. And the Globe had done a story, nothing special, but a story on that event. And the same woman who immediately, you know, my Pavlovian response is, oh, here it comes again. And she said, I'm here today to warmly congratulate the Globe for its excellent coverage of the incident on Melnia Cass Boulevard in which a passenger was very badly injured. That was great. And I'm going, oh, my goodness, you know, I've never heard this before. She liked something we did. I'm starting to relax and kind of put my feet up. And this was a classic example of good community journalism and a terrific job. And I'm going, my God, the world is changing. And suddenly her voice changed and she went, because the moral of the story is that shows exactly the damage that rocks can do to the human skull, which is why the fact that you constantly suggest that the Palestinians throwing rocks are not a serious threat to the Israel IDF are wrong. And she then went into her 15-minute why the Globe coverage of Israel was wrong. So it was one of the great sort of feints and deceptions of all time, and she had to go and do it for about 2 or 3 minutes. Anyway, I do want to talk about ethics today. And I want to talk about them both in theory and in practice, because there's often a big difference. I used to teach a course in media ethics at Northeastern and Tufts University. And the first thing I would say was, no, it's not an oxymoron. The way I taught the course is this. There are a lot of rules, and I think you're maybe from listening to Rabbi, the previous speaker, indicated that. Most reputable news organizations and ones that take themselves seriously have a fairly long, lengthy, and sophisticated code of ethics. There are a lot of rules. They're written down. All the journalists have access to them, and most of the rules are fairly well thought out and fairly sensible and certainly fundamentally wise, more or less. But I decided I was going to teach the ethics course by trying to teach people those rules. In my book, there are fundamentally three rules in journalism. Don't plagiarize. Don't fabricate, i.e. don't turn something that is fiction into nonfiction. And don't get involved in a conflict of interest. By that I mean, if you're covering the police department, don't accept a case of scotch from the police chief at Christmas. Okay. Other than that, my attitude is, it was almost irrelevant to try and teach people these codes of ethics because many of them vanished in the heat of battle. No matter what the journalistic organizations did and thought about, and obviously some are more sophisticated and serious than others, in many cases you would see some of those rules and some of those good intentions go astray under the pressure of competition and deadline in a newsroom. So what I did in the media ethics course was I tried to think of a way of a code, not of ethics, but a code for thinking about making ethical decisions. And it had three legs. The first was called thinking. And by that I meant simply, you need to evaluate the situation. When you're in a quandary about whether you should publish this, what should you publish, who would be harmed, who would be helped, who would be served, the first thing you need to do is think clearly about the situation at hand. Evaluate it closely. Once you understand what you're dealing with, the second leg of it is what I call values. And that is, you need to apply your own personal values and or the values of your news organization to the situation. Now, if your values don't dovetail with the values of your news organization, you have a problem, usually. Not every time, but generally speaking, if that's the case, you're in trouble. And news organizations do have different values. The Boston Herald has different values than the Boston Globe. The New York Post has different values than the New York Times. So the second thing is, once you understand the situation, is to apply the values. The third thing is really an outgrowth of the first two, and it's simply this. When you make the decision, as you're making the decision about what you want to do, you need to be fundamentally prepared to be able to justify it to the community at large. I.e., once you've applied those values, thought about the situation, you've got to be able to say to yourself, can I explain this rationally to people? Is there a coherent and cogent series of thoughts and processes that went into effect here that would allow me to stand up in front of a room and basically tell people, this is why we did it. You don't necessarily have to agree with me, but this is why we did it. And that was what I taught people in this class. Those were the three legs of it. Because in many cases, some of the ethical blunders that I would see happen in journalism were not caused necessarily because of the kind of decision a newspaper made or a news outlet made, whether it was right or wrong, but the fact that they in many ways would betray their own values or not adhere to their own values simply because they weren't following a process of thinking about the situation. So that at the end of that three-step process, when they were standing there in front of a community of their peers, the answer, and I was, in many cases, I was that community, because as the ombudsman, it would often be my job to say, what happened here? And editors would sometimes say to me, what happened here was, we didn't have a lot of time to think about this, or we were worried about what somebody else was going to do, which is not the right answer in this situation. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of what I mean. And these were cases that actually cropped up when I was the ombudsman of the paper. And these are examples of news organizations fundamentally sort of betraying in some ways their own ethics or not thinking through their own ethical situation. One of them was a case involving a woman named Lilia Fagundes. And I'll give you a little background. The Globe newsroom, like many newsrooms to this day, have a policy when it comes to a criminal suspect, identifying a criminal suspect who's still at large, and particularly when it comes to the race of that suspect. And the policy is that you do not identify a suspect by their race if that's all you have to go by, i.e., police think a black man did it. Police think a Hispanic did it. Police think a white man did it. Aren't in stories anymore, because the theory is that that kind of identification potentially stigmatizes the entire community while not giving the public enough information to be able to actually help in the apprehension anyway. So the rule basically is, if you've got enough information that would help somebody actually identify the suspect, like he's a black person who's between 17 and 20, 5 foot 10 to 6 feet tall, wearing a red then you obviously publish it. But if it's just a broad sweeping, this is the race of the suspect, you don't publish it. One of the reasons, by the way, that that happened was because of a very famous case in Boston 20 years ago called the Stewart murder case. I don't know if you guys have talked about it at all, but to go over it very quickly, it was a story of a man who essentially was going to a birthing class with his wife at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She was about to give birth. She was close to giving birth. He called a police dispatcher, and his wife was mortally wounded. The fetus was mortally wounded. He himself was wounded. His name was Charles Stewart. He called the cops and said, basically, a black guy jumped into my car and shot my wife and me. Well, the entire city was turned upside down looking for that black suspect. Almost every person of color in Mission Hill was searched on site by police officers for days. When they finally the thing unraveled at the end, it turned out that the husband himself, Charles Stewart, had killed his wife. And actually, to this day, it's not clear whether he shot himself and shot himself a little more severely than he wanted to, or his brother, who was an accomplice in the scheme, actually shot him at his directive to deflect suspicion from him. But it was one of the great hoaxes of all time, and it became a huge national story in which the Boston media, they actually even like, found a suspect, the guy, a poor guy by the name of Willie Bryson, poor guy, he was a career criminal anyway, but he didn't happen to commit this crime, and his name was Willie Bennett, and the entire city was fooled, and the only thing resolved itself when Charles Stewart, under increasing suspicion, actually jumped to his death from the Tobin Bridge. Several months after this thing happened. That was one of the reasons why they changed the policy on entering as the suspect. So when this case happened, there was a very unusual thing that happened in Lilia's Kugundis case. And that was that she gave, according to the police, she was shot. She was a Cambridge store owner who was shot in her own store and fatally wounded. And according to the police, she gave a dying declaration, which, by the way, in some cases is admissible in court, strange as it seems, because it's obviously hearsay, but in some criminal cases it can be admissible in court, in which she told the police she was shot by two black men. That's a very unusual situation. Armed with that kind of information, most of the media outlets in Boston published that dying declaration, even though it went against their stated policy. Because this was a highly unusual situation. It was the woman's last words. And so it seemed to be more than just simply the norm. So they decided in this situation they would publish the race of the suspect. The Boston Globe did not. I was the ombudsman. The Boston Globe received a lot of complaints. Most people who accused it of this wrong-headed political correctness and, you know, and bending over backwards not to offend a race in a case like this. Everybody else is naming the race. And so they ascribed motives to the Globe that essentially had to do with politics or philosophy or ideology. Well, I actually investigated, and here's what happened. I talked to two of the leading editors of the paper, one of whom was an African-American himself, and he said, frankly, we didn't know. I didn't know that this dying declaration had occurred. Had I known that, I basically would have. We would have made a decision that under these incredibly unusual circumstances, we would have allowed her dying declaration to be part of the story. But we didn't know. Well, he didn't know. Truth is, the reporters and people in the newsroom working on the story knew that. They assumed that because of the Globe rule that they would not name the race of the suspect. They did not come to their editors and say, we ought to have a conversation about this because this is what happened and maybe we want to rethink our rule in this case only. So essentially, the Globe's justification for not naming the race of the suspect in this case was, not that we made a decision based on our values and principles and applied it. We didn't communicate. That was the reason. More or less, they didn't quite say that, but that's exactly what it was. I will give you another example. How many people here know who Reggie Lewis is? It's a long time ago. Okay. Reggie Lewis was a former star of the Boston Celtics who in 1993, at age 27, dropped dead while shooting a heart problem while shooting baskets at a gym. Circumstances being what they were, there was a lot of speculation about possible drug use with him. And the idea of drug abuse was thoroughly investigated by journalists in this city. But there was no smoking gun. Nothing to definitively prove it by traditional reporting standards. The Globe itself published a lengthy report on his death, in which the idea of drug use somehow being a contributing factor was not a focus of the story at all. The next year, the paper launched another investigation to reopen the issue. And as fundamentally, as an editor there told me, we couldn't find anything that would meet our standards of publication that suggested that drug use was an issue here. So they published nothing. So that was two bites of the apple. So essentially the Reggie Lewis story was pretty much over. And then in March 1995, almost 3 years after Reggie Lewis had died, the Wall Street Journal wrote a story on page one. The Wall Street Journal story, and we won't go into how good or bad that story was, but suffice it to say, claimed that cocaine was a central issue in the death of Reggie Lewis. Well, suddenly, what do we have here? We had an out-of-town paper, a big national paper, but an out-of-town paper, essentially breaking the story that the Boston papers couldn't break and embarrassing, to some extent, the local media. They had the cocaine angle, or purported to have the cocaine angle, the drug angle, that the local papers couldn't nail down for all this reporting. What happened? Suddenly, the Globe and the Herald reopened the Reggie Lewis case, and boy, the floodgates opened. The Globe published a story from a former college teammate of Lewis's who said he did cocaine with him. Now, that man later recanted that testimony. The Herald produced a former drug dealer and an unnamed medical source, not saying that Lewis had used cocaine. In other words, once a big national paper had come and done a story that the local papers couldn't get on a local hero, not only did they reopen the story, but in some ways, they changed their standards for publication because of the pressure put on. One of the editors at the Globe told me flatly, we couldn't ignore the journal story, no matter how flawed it may have been. The drug issue was fully in play, whether we wanted or not. So essentially, to some degree, the paper changed its standards because the journal made them do it. And not only the Globe, but the Herald as well. And in that case, as well as the case I just gave you, it seems to me there's a clear example of a news organization, in some ways, violating its own ethics and standards and principles in the heat of battle. So that fundamentally, when it comes to part three of that three-part process, standing up and justifying what they did, they didn't really have a justification that would go over pretty, I don't think, well in this room or almost any other room. It is harder in this day and age for any journalistic organization or any journalism, any individual's journalist, to stick to his or her standards. That's even harder now than it was 10 or 15 years ago when I was writing about this. Because we live in an era when the media environment has changed dramatically and has fragmented dramatically, we now have so many more choices, so many more options, so many more news outlets with so many different varying standards, and particularly when it comes to issues of privacy and exposing personal behavior to public view. We've gone from a system of what I would call gatekeeper journalism to a system of what I would call guided journalism. What was gatekeeper journalism? Gatekeeper journalism, and that was really the term I was for, was sort of when a few powerful journalists knew things and made decisions about whether or not the public should know them. I will give you an example. John Kennedy, president from 1960 to 1963. As it turns out, John Kennedy's personal behavior in the White House and his attitude toward women would make Bill Clinton look like a monk. That was not known. It has subsequently become known. It certainly had become known after he left office. But it was never, ever revealed in any way, shape, or form to the American public at that time. And one of the reasons was, and there were journalists who knew about it, but in those days there were just a handful of powerful news organizations that really controlled the flow of information. Maybe the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the AP. Maybe ABC, NBC, and CBS Washington Bureau. Maybe Newsweek and Time. But there are, you could almost count on two hands the number of powerful journalists who would have access to that information. And they would often have very close relationships with people in power. And they would make decisions about whether or not the rest of us should know about that. I'm not saying they made wrong decisions in deciding we should, but they were the gatekeepers. And if they shut the gate, the information spigot was over. And essentially that was the end. Now we have something that I didn't come up with the term gatekeeper journalism, but I did come up with the term geyser journalism. And by that I simply mean that now, rather than journalism seeping from the top down, it explodes from the bottom up. Now, even if most mainstream news organizations make a decision that a story is not worthy of publication, that it doesn't meet standards of publication, somebody else on the food chain is going to publish it. Whether it's Matt Drudge, whether it's the National Enquirer, whether it's Larry Flint, whether it's somebody who doesn't in any way, shape, or form share the standards of most mainstream journalists, that information is going to explode from out from under the ground. Somewhere it's going to find the hole, it's going to blow into public view, and then the rest of the news media have to respond to it, even if they've already made individual decisions that they're not comfortable with the story. And essentially, that's the environment that we live in now, and it makes it much more difficult for journalistic standards to sort of survive this kind of pressure and scrutiny. So I want to talk to you a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
Not familiar with all the examples you gave of these things, but certainly when it comes to the National Enquirer, wouldn't an ad hominem attack be sufficient to suppress any sort of information that came out?
Here's the problem. The National Enquirer has actually had a pretty good track record of getting stories right lately. Let's look at some of the things the National Enquirer broke. The National Enquirer, and I was going to go into this in a minute, broke the John Edwards story, Infidelity story, when the rest of the mainstream media wouldn't touch it, and when he was actually a presidential candidate, something that eventually became a huge story. The Bill Clinton affair with Jennifer Flowers was broken by The Star, the National Enquirer's cousin. Larry Flint, we need to say more about his journalistic scruple, by offering a $1 million reward for information, actually got information that forced the Speaker of the House in 1998, Bob Livingston, who was going to succeed Newt Gingrich, to resign before he took office because of an affair he had. So, yes, the rest of the mainstream media can fundamentally say, well, look who did it, the National Enquirer. But the bottom line is they actually have been getting some of this stuff right. And then they're forcing other people to pay attention to it. Having said that, there is one great National Enquirer anecdote that I will tell you about, which is that one of the other rules in sort of rules too strong or guidelines in journalism was that identities of victims of rape or sexual assault are not revealed. And the thinking there, unless they voluntarily want their names used. And the thinking there obviously is this is the kind of crime that's intimidating enough. It's very difficult to report it. There are a lot of factors that would mitigate people coming forward and talking about one thing like this happened to them. And the idea of them having their names publicized is just another deterrent. So the basic thinking is, certainly, you do not name the individual who's been a victim of sexual assault. Well, there's a famous rape case now many years ago in which William Kennedy Smith, who was one of the Kennedy family kids, was accused of raping a woman in Florida. And it turned out to be a huge trial. And the lengths to which most of the media went to shield the identity of the woman at some point, almost comical. There were actually live coverage of the trial, and at one point, when she was taking the stand and testifying, a big blue bubble was superimposed over her head on the TV screen so you couldn't see her. And if she moved, you could see part of her face. I mean, it was a whole intricate dance about how to protect her identity. Well, for some reason, the New York Times decided that they were going to write a story about her that suggested that not necessarily that she hadn't been raped, but certainly that she lived a fast and loose lifestyle. And it was a very unusual story for the New York Times that essentially it was a kind of a guilt by behavior story that cast doubts on her largely by suggesting that she liked to party. no other way of putting it, and going into some great, and they named it. They actually named it, and they wanted, and they, at that point, the rest of the media had not named her, and they, when people were so shocked that the New York Times divulged this name, that they actually went to the editor of the National Enquirer and said, well, now that her, she's been identified, the name by the way was Patricia Bowman, said, are you going to name? And the editor of the National Enquirer probably waited his entire life and said, of course not. Who do you think we are? The New York Times? So, you know, it can work both ways. Let's take the Mark Sanford scandal. Okay, that's a, one that's fresh in everybody's mind. Okay? A couple of weeks ago, missing for a few days, the governor of South Carolina. No one knows where he is. He's hiking the Appalachian Trail at first. Maybe he's not. He flies back into the country. A reporter from a newspaper comes up to him, asks him a couple of questions. The next thing we have is a press conference, and he talking about the love of his life and the woman in Argentina, and he's going to try and fall back in love with his wife, and we don't know if he's going to be governor again or not. So it was quite a story. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, because we measure news content, it was a huge story for one day until Michael Jackson died. And then the story kind of vanished from the headlines. But the day before Michael Jackson died, it was dominating the news. Now here's the interesting thing. The South Carolina paper, it's finally sort of caught up to him at the airport, actually had, I don't know if you guys have seen how closely you follow the story, not to be advertising, but there were also a bunch of emails between he and his loved one, his mistress, that were publicized, and they're pretty florid, and I don't know, goofy, some, you know, emotional, teenage almost in there, but anyway, they don't help them, let's put it that way. The main newspaper in South Carolina had gotten those emails months earlier. These emails clearly suggested a relationship between Sanford and this woman. There's no doubt about that. They're pledging their love to each other. Now, they claimed, and I won't give them, that they couldn't authenticate those emails. They couldn't verify that they were accurate or authentic. And so obviously months went by, and this sort of mystery trip had to take place before the story actually broke. Now, I'll ask you guys a question. You be the editor of that newspaper. Someone, I'm not sure how it gets into your newsroom, from a bunch of emails between the governor of your state and this woman, okay, pledging their love to each other. There's no mystery about the intention here. They're clearly having an affair. Something major is going on. And somebody says, I got some emails for you. You don't have any outside evidence other than what you've been told right now, although you may have your suspicions. If you're the editor of that paper, do you ignore the story completely because you don't have any evidence? Do you pursue the story aggressively at that moment? Or do you kind of pursue it half-heartedly, waiting for something else to happen? What would you do? Yeah.
Can I ask a question, actually, about the purpose of the newspaper?
Sure.
So if I'm a reader, why should I care?
Why should you care?
What the senator does in his own...
Governor?
Governor.
Okay. Here's the question. Okay, so if it's his own private life, it's your standard, right? Okay.
I might
revise that term. No, fair enough. No, I mean, that's the ethical quandary between when does an individual's private life affect his public behavior. Well, here's a couple of complicating factors. Number one, on some trips that the governor took during the quote-unquote public business, that were official trips, he actually diverted from what he was supposed to be doing to see this woman. Okay. Well, and frankly, that's being looked at, although I don't know, but at a bare minimum, he was on official business. It wasn't in private, in some cases, when he met with his wife. In your mind, does that change you? Now you want to know as a citizen.
I think he did the wrong thing, but,
You still don't care?
No.
Okay. I'm not advocating, that's why we play the game. I'm not saying there's a right answer or wrong. I think a lot of people feel. What if the governor, who in this case happened to be a fairly conservative Republican, sort of preaches as part of his political persona family values and home and heart and the importance of family and all of sort of the cultural issues that may go on. But the fact that he's cheating on his wife now. Some questions will pop into your mind. Well, one, you know, this isn't keeping with this guy's public persona. Two, wow, this is a woman in Argentina. How many trips did he take? You know, so I mean, they might just raise those questions, and they might also say, let's investigate it, but we don't know when we're going to publish. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing to think about is on the editor's newspaper, and my guess is we know that people like to read these stories. People are talking about it. I have a duty to my readership to get them true stories which they want to read.
Why do you think, even if they don't necessarily think it's important, they're just a salacious act.
I don't mean, unless they tell me they don't think it's important, the only evidence I have is that they buy more of my papers. Apparently they do think it's important.
Okay, so you're taking somewhat of a marketing.
I think, you know, depending on what kind of evidence he has, I mean, all he has is someone handing these emails and says these are emails. You need a fake email.
No.
I think he absolutely has a duty to, or I as the editor absolutely have the duty to pursue the story aggressively and find out if it's true or not.
And that's why there's a pursuit issue, because pursuit is different than publication,
right.
Obviously. You never know. You don't publish anything you're not confident in. But the question is how...
I think this is clearly a story that most readers in America are interested in. It was the biggest story of the day when it broke for certain.
It certainly was. And he has,
here, this is the kind of people are interested in this. They think it's important for whatever reason.
And he has subsequently, by the way, been censured by the Republican Party in South Carolina. I don't think he's done it so far. I mean, it may impact his political future. He probably will not step down
as well. As a media critic, the question I would ask is, what's the point of people's political commitments? They didn't pursue the story aggressively if they didn't. That would come to be my first question. What is it for, like, it's not even necessarily intentional bias, but just, this guy's a good guy, he wouldn't do something like this, he's too deep on people. And I think you have a duty to get past that and try and find the story.
What you were going to say, Tony?
I mean, I don't know if you know how this is doing, definitely. And at that point, the readership,
Some do, some don't. Yeah.
Right. It's not unanimous,
but
then, as an editor, do you have an obligation, is your obligation to give the public the news they want to read? Or do you have a moral obligation to give the public the news they should be getting?
Very huge question in journalism.
So, in that sense, I think it's something where you actually pursue it, not directly, you pursue it kind of quietly and when it still comes out. I guess we have to determine, it doesn't cross the line from being private issues to actually, impacting on a public scale for certain.
Marketing questions aside, for the purpose of this discussion, let's focus on the idea of whether or not the public should know about this particular event. And, I mean, because, yes.
Two questions. One is, obviously this is not as big a story as John Kennedy.
Well, not, no, except but although we didn't find out about any of this stuff in the Kennedy was dead, correct.
Right, so I'm interested in do you think, what shifted, right, in that, you talked about the democratization that comes against other media, does that mean that the only reason that we published these stories now, just more than 4 years ago, is that lesser people will get hold of them anyway, so we can't
speak
otherwise, or because we have a fundamental shift in the person's experience, in our understanding of private and public life, and understanding the person's journalism. That's one second question that is, aggressively or investigating half-heartedly, at this point, what resources are devoted, or what damage are willing to cause in the process of finding out the truth?
Let me take the first book first. We said in the quiz show. A lot of things have changed, and now I'm theorizing. Okay, I mean, this is not science, this is art. One thing that's clearly changed is obviously when I talk about from gatekeeper to geyser, that is a structural issue in journalism. There are simply so many more people out there with so many different kinds of standards, and you know the barriers to publication are so much easier now. I mean, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I don't know why this day it seems patently unfair to me that the 21-year-old girl. The scandal was named for the 21-year-old woman, not for the 50-year-old man who was president of the United States, who was an equal participant in the Monica Lewinsky scandal in 1998 was broken technically by Matt Drudge. Like, anybody know who Drudge is? Okay. Matt Drudge is the guy who has a website called the Drudge Report. And he essentially is a kind of a journal gossip. So he will post things, it is widely followed. Very widely thought about it as being. He will post things. He aggregates content from a lot of reliable sources and mainstream and stuff. But he will post rumors and gossip and stuff like that that basically nobody else will, or that mainstream media organization will. And then everybody else picks up on it, fundamentally. So, and he's also happens to be politically conservative, which does affect his decision making. In 1998, it was Newsweek magazine that had actually embarked on a year-long investigation of the fact that Ken Starr, a special prosecutor, was looking into this relationship between a White House intern and the President of the United States. They were about to publish a story in their magazine, but at the last minute, and partly due to a request from some of the prosecutors and others, as they were closing, and literally Newsweek makes their final decisions over the weekend, they decided, you know, we're not quite comfortable with this. We want to wait another week. Well, somebody called up Matt Drudge, who was highly connected to the story, and said, Newsweek isn't running this story. Let me tell you what happened here. You got to go with this. Maybe they're getting cold feet. I'm not sure. And Drudge simply posted on his website, without having done any of the reporting, knowing nothing of the story, you know, investigation of President Clinton having sex with an intern. So to this day, or similarly in the immediate aftermath, he went around calling himself the Bob Woodward of this particular scandal. The man who broke the Monica Lewinsky Bill Clinton scandal. And in fact, without knowing, doing any of the reporting, he simply popped it on his website. And from that moment on, the story exploded. Newsweek magazine, the magazine that had made a decision based on their own sense of ethics and propriety to hold the story for one measly week, was forced for the first time ever to publish the story online on their website before whatever, you know, primitive version of a website they had back then, 1998, before it actually hit their print version, simply because they had watched their own story been stolen from out from under their eyes. So, there is a structural issue, and there is no doubt that there are just so many more people with so many different standards who will publish things that end up having to be paid attention to, that part of it. But I would say that there was a bigger impetus for this sort of public-private switch, and this is my own theory. And it is, it has something to do with two failed presidencies in a row. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson decided he was not going to seek re-election, despite the fact that he had won his first election after over Barry Goldwater by the biggest landslide in American presidential history, because he had been essentially beaten down by the war in Vietnam. And you guys are way, way, way too young to remember what Lyndon Johnson's speeches on TV, but I'm not, unfortunately. And I can remember, Lyndon Johnson would come on TV, and you could literally, the war in Vietnam was raging, there was no end to it. He was really a president with a very expansive domestic agenda, the Great Society that he wanted to focus on, but he could not figure out a way to end this war. It just got to be a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger quagmire. And you could see it literally destroying him. He was aging in front of our faces, and he used to come on TV, and maybe the comedians made this up, but it almost seemed like the first line out of his mouth every time was, "My fellow Americans," he would say with that Texas drawl, "it is with a heavy heart that I come to you." I mean, we didn't want to see the guy on TV. When he was coming on TV and talking to us, it was bad news, and we knew that. And shockingly, he did have challenges in 1968 from his own party, from the left wing. Both Bobby Kennedy, the president, the brother of John Kennedy, and Gene McCarthy, who was an anti-war candidate, and he chose not to run for re-election and literally left office a beaten man, one clearly haunted by a war he could not finish and could not figure out how to get out of. it was he was seen as a failed president, a man who had sort of been literally almost under, ejected from office as a defeated man. He was followed by Richard Nixon, who won a 49 state, who won in 1968 a very narrow win after Johnson got out, and in 1972 won by carrying 49 out of the 50 states. The only state he did not carry anyway, no, we have any history since then, yes.
Massachusetts and D.C.
Massachusetts and D.C., and I was going to school in Massachusetts in those days, and a very popular bumper sticker several years later was, "Don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts." Correct. He won a huge landslide, and what did he do? He ended up being the first president to have to resign from office, driven out from by a Watergate scandal of growing proportions that seemed motivated at the end of the day by his own strange brand of paranoia and whatever other demons were eating away at a guy who could have been just running the country almost by fiat, but instead was obsessed with his own enemies. And I mean, it is hard for you guys to believe, understand, or remember the trauma that accompanied the final days of the Nixon administration. But there was a night called the Saturday Night Massacre in which he tried to get various people in the Justice Department to fire the special prosecutor for Watergate, and when Elliot Richardson, the Attorney General, wouldn't do it, he was fired, or he resigned, and the man under him wouldn't do it, he resigned, and it almost, there were times when it actually seemed like the constitutional government of the United States of America seemed to be teetering by a thread. I mean, no one would have been shocked in those days if we woke up one morning to the news that tanks were surrounding the White House, you know, and pointing out, not it. Anyway, Nixon left, having put the country through incredible trauma, as a defeated man by his own demon. At the same time, and not only that, but he was a man who was driven out by the power of the press. This was the Washington Post that broke the Watergate story with Woodward and Bernstein. And not only, and so there was this sort of great feeling of power on the part of the press. I think at that moment, the combination of the sense of the press being able to change events and the idea that character counted. I think after two failed presidencies in 68 and 72, there was a growing sense in the country, we need to know more about what's inside the heads and the minds and the hearts of these people we elect. After seeing what happened to Johnson and Nixon, it was no longer, okay, I want to know where they stand on this, and I want to know what they think about that. It was like, somehow, the press is not doing enough to tell us about the things that end up affecting a president. Like, what are these men really like? And I think that began to morph into an idea that part of the president's job was to examine character in a way that they had not before. And I think that definition of character began to expand dramatically. Demons, yes, personalities, and yes, in its most obvious form, marital relations and fidelity and infidelity. Now, I would argue, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, that marital infidelity, we can all argue until the cows come home, forget about whether it's a sin or not, but whether or not the public has a right to know about a powerful individual who may or may not be cheating his wife in a private way that doesn't affect his behavior. But there are some times, clearly, when those cases are, and those cases do, are something that the public has a right to know about. And I'll give you one example. 1988, Gary Hart. Gary Hart ran for president in 1984. He was on the Democratic ticket. He was beaten by Walter Mondale, who had been vice president under Jimmy Carter, in a close race, fairly close race. And he was expected, and he, of course, Mondale was clobbered by Ronald Reagan. When 1988 rolled around, Hart was kind of the heir apparent on the Democratic side, and he was the guy who was expected to win the nomination. During the 1984 campaign, there was a lot of speculation and buzz that Gary was not exactly the most faithful husband, but nothing really came of it. Nobody decided to write about it. As the 88 race came around, it was really 1987, when he was clearly the guy who was looking to get the Democratic nomination, and no doubt the front runner, some of those stories began to repercolate. And there were actually stories in the Washington Post and stories in Newsweek magazine that sort of raised the issue and fundamentally said, in almost no uncertain terms, well, Gary Hart, you know, might be the next president of the United States, certainly the next Democratic nominee, if he can frankly control himself. I mean, and in some ways, it was a you know, almost they warn each other across the bow. Look, we're watching you, buddy. You know, whether we had the right to watch him or not had the right to watch him, we could talk about him. But clearly, Hart was warned. So much so that he gave an interview to the New York Times Magazine in 1987, big Sunday magazine story, and they asked him about rumors about his behavior with other women. And he said this, follow me around. You won't find anything. Just follow me around. Now, by one of the most either bitter, unfortunate, or delicious ironies you could possibly imagine, that story was published on May 3rd, 1987. Now, you have to understand, for a Boston, for a New York Times Sunday magazine, there's a lot of lead time. That means that that interview was probably conducted in March or April. It takes a long time for one of the stories to be written, edited, and then published. So that interview was taken place weeks earlier, if not months. But it happened to come out on May 3rd, 1987. That was the very day that the Miami Herald literally decided to follow Gary Hart around, had staked out his Washington, D.C. townhouse, and found Donna Rice running out the back door. Okay. So we can now say, in the Donna Rice affair, clearly sunk the Hart candidacy, and he eventually withdrew from the race after a few fits and starts. Now, one can argue in that particular case, who cares about whether he has an affair or not? Doesn't have anything to do with what kind of president he might be, except that in some way you can also make a compelling argument at this point that having been warned, having been running for president and preparing to run for president for some time, having run in two successive cycles, having essentially been warned by everybody, the press and others, that, look, there's an issue here, we're watching it, this man, daring the media to follow him around, still couldn't control himself, which gets into a whole different series of of issues that might be of legitimate interest for people trying to evaluate a presidential candidate. Like, does he have a problem controlling his urges and his impulses? Or B, does he have some horrible self-destructive quality to him here? I mean, this was couldn't be evaluated as a case of infidelity. Had to be evaluated as something else, and maybe a more significant cash issue. So my first answer, that's a long-winded way of saying, I think that the press began to think the character was something that they needed to vet. And I would also say that coincided with a change in the American political system. The political reforms that came around in the 70s with nominating conventions. In the old days, candidates were often vetted for high office, were often vetted by the party bosses. I mean, the smoke-filled rooms, that's kind of a metaphor, but the truth was, on some level, there were a meeting of the minds where people said, we like this guy, but you know, he drinks too much. Or, we like this guy, but nah, he chases women. This guy's, the process of elimination often came through that kind of a very closed environment. Well, the electoral process was opened up, and that meant that the vetting that had been done in those smoke-filled rooms wasn't being done. So the combination of the Johnson-Nixon presidencies and the idea that there's now kind of a vetting gap led the press to believe that their role now needed to be more than simply what are the candidates saying, but there had to be a further exploration of their characters, which now may have gotten completely out of hand and control. But I think that was the impulse for it. Now, your second question was... legitimate investigating more aggressively means devoting more resources and energy to it. I think there are two different things. And I, as a journalist, I can say this myself. There are stories that I aggressively investigated that I never reported. And that means you say, wow, if this is true, it's important. And I'm going to do my darndest to find out whether it's true or not. And that means I'm going to spend time on it. I'm going to be focused on it. I'm going to be pretty relentless on it. I'm going to spend energy on it. At the end of the day, the decision whether to publish is a whole different set of decisions. But there's I'm going to focus, this is a priority, and within a newsroom, what does that mean? You know, does that mean we're going to put 5 reporters on it, not 3 reporters? We're going to take them off everything they're doing for 2 weeks. We're going to meet about this 3 times a week to see where we are and then get updates. That's aggressively pursuing the story. It is not, in no way, shape, or form, should it be some form of pre-publication that somehow, you know, sort of leaks out some of the information that can't be proven. Which, that's, anyway, would be my assessment of it.
Okay. There are two sort of related questions. First, when you're talking about the difference between the gatekeeper and geyser model.
Yes. And I hope you guys use the word geyser, because I swear I definitely want somebody to so I can say, I invented that for
you. But I'm wondering, you seem to be emphasizing more that the people, the gatekeepers, you know, felt like they were making the right moral choice by not giving this information. And unfortunately, there are slimy, now that we're in a world with a Geyser model, these slimy people are going to publish anyway. We might as well do it so that they don't beat us out. And I'm wondering, because that's the story I feel like you're telling us.
I am.
And I don't know. There's part of me that wonders, you know, you're talking about a situation in which, you know, three television networks and a certain small number of major newspapers are the people who are giving you news, and they have a chummy relationship with...
Or chummier.
Sure. You know, chummy relationship with the people in power. And they're very concerned about access, and it's really easy when there's only 8 news sources in the country, you know, and 2 in a city, you know, to cut off to say, if someone runs a story that you don't like, you know, you play the game. You cut them off, and the other 9 all have access, and all of a sudden that person's and his business is gone.
So I
just wonder, like, how much that kind of thing also plays in.
I think there are, when you talk about the gatekeeper model.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then there's the follow up is, so do you think that now that the, not just the gatekeeper, but the Geyser model, in general, the institutions, the business model for reporting is kind of falling apart right now. Like, the ways in which you can fund investigative journalism are slowly disappearing.
Right.
Do you think that has an effect on, that can or should have an effect on journalistic ethics?
Sure. Well, let me do the first one first, which is by no means, I'm not trying to lionize the gatekeepers, to be honest with you. I mean, it was a smaller universe, so it was easy to keep a secret. Some secrets they may have kept simply, you're right, because they were, because of relationships or access, and trading access. Frankly, there were also, you know, it was a different time socially. Cultural mores were completely, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was caught in the middle of a campaign having an affair with somebody and lying about it. He was elected president of the United States. He served 2 terms. Nelson Rockefeller was once essentially, back in the 1960s, everybody basically wrote off his presidential ambitions because he had been divorced, period. End of story. Nothing, you know, no affairs. He had an amicable and normal divorce. I mean, at one point, divorce was enough to disqualify a politician for higher office. So, clearly, you know, people, what shocks people today did not shock them. Obviously, studies moved on those kind of issues as well. It is not to say that the gatekeepers were necessarily more sagacious or that they were even doing it for really ethical reasons. It's just to say that it was easier to shut off the spigot. Certainly, most people say, yes, access did have plenty to do with it. Absolutely. And so did relationships. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And so did, and you know, and people can argue, well, they were paternalistic. So how dare they decide? You know, there are a lot of people out there who will tell you, look, the public should essentially be able to get everything learn everything that's true, and then, in their infinite wisdom, decide on the significance or importance of it. So you can make, you know, you can make a real paternalistic, you know, arrogance rap against those people as well. On the investigative side, I will just say this. Investigative journalism is, first of all, the business model of journalism, and I'll talk about a little bit more of this tonight, is obviously a mess. I mean, you guys are living through what is going to be a major, major transformation in the media universe. And nobody could have anticipated it, frankly. And what the problem is we're stuck between two business models. I'll sort of go off a little tangent here for a minute. The old mainstream business model that was a mainstream media business model that was built on advertising, you know, and that drove newspaper companies to have profit margins of 20% is dead. And it's dead for 2 primary reasons. One is the fact that young people no longer read newspapers, the migration of eyeballs online, The fact that there's a whole generation, your generation of people that grew up without ever having to pay even if the measly 25 cents for news in any way, shape, or form. And all of the loss of classified advertising to online venues has essentially put a gaping wound in the mainstream media journalism world. I mean, we are talking, I worked for the Buffalo Bill for 10 years. The Buffalo was the 800-pound gorilla around here. You know, it was one of the biggest, most potent, most powerful institutions in New England. Forget about Massachusetts. It was sold, it was bought 50 years ago for $1.1 billion. Today, and if you follow the story, it's conceivably on the market. There are people who think it could be sold for $1, that it may not fetch, that the New York Times company might have to pay somebody a couple hundred million to take it, just for the unfunded pension liability. So that's how dramatically the business has changed. And the other part of it is, the problem is, in some ways it's irony. It's really ironic. It's not an audience problem. It's a revenue problem. Because the truth is, let's look at the Boston Globe. Between its website, boston.com, and its newspaper, it has more people looking at its content than ever before. It's just that nobody's paying anymore. So while all the eyeballs are going online, people are going online, the news industry has not figured out how to make anybody pay for information online. They haven't figured out how to make you consumers pay for it. They're talking about things like micropayments and things like that. But they haven't figured out a way to charge you guys in a way that you'll pay. And it's too late, although they think about it now all the time. They never figured out a way to get the people like the Googles of the world, who made a fortune taking news content and slicing and dicing and aggregating it, they never figured out how to make them pay for it. And so you look at that and the fact that the display advertising model is not going to work online. And the real problem in journalism today, the Boston Globe, everybody talks about the newspaper, no one's reading it. The biggest newspaper, the Globe newspaper, still is responsible for 90% of the revenue for the Globe paper and website because of the advertising. The real problem in journalism today is that there is no business plan that's working for online journalism. So what does that mean? Yes, investigative journalism is one of the first things that got cut in many places because it's expensive and it takes a long time. How is that going to play itself out? You know, one of the interesting things, I don't know if you guys ever heard of ProPublica? Do you know what it is? That's, in a way, this is sort of where the news universe is going. As investigative journalism, less and less of it is done by media organizations. There's now one sort of big newsroom, about a 25-person, might be slightly bigger now, investigative journalism outlet called ProPublica. Its top editor used to work for the Wall Street Journal. And essentially they've gotten all the investigative journalists in one spot to try and create this sort of investigative journalism network, and they'll share their content with outsiders. And that's probably how a lot of things in journalism are going to be done right now. Yeah.
You want to explain a bit about how time considerations affect ethical considerations, because you just had a speaker coming from a weekly newspaper.
Sure.
And you mentioned that you certainly hinted at daily newspapers having very long time spans on certain stories, and yet they're also daily newspapers. So sure. Earlier, if you could explain a bit about that.
Well, you mean the time pressure on...
What sort of time pressure are we talking about?
Sure.
How does it affect different types of stories,
well,
and how does it
influence that conversation? Certainly, the simplest thing I can say about time pressure is that that means, frankly, the more instantaneous the news cycle becomes, the less time there is for that three-step process. Okay. And that sounds simple. But, I mean, there were a couple of classic cases for example, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. A guy named Steve Brill had a magazine called Content Magazine. It was a very sophisticated magazine that looked at ethical issues in journalism. And his first issue came out, it was all about how did the media actually behave during that whole year-long Lewinsky impeachment ordeal. And among the things we found out was that there were literally, the Dallas Morning News, I think, was a news organization that at one point literally sent a story about somebody seeing Lewinsky and Clinton together in the White House somewhere and pressed the button to publish it without even getting a response from the White House, essentially, because there wasn't enough time. Okay. Larry King one night essentially read a story that came over the wires that made an allegation that later had to be retracted, and immediately asked his guests, so what do you think about this? On something that actually never even occurred. So obviously the one of the driving forces in journalism has always been competition. And do we get the story first? And where are we in the continuum of getting stories? Now, the truth is that's very much an internal journalistic urge. Well, it's in the DNA of every journalist. It's like, I got this first. We got it today. Yeah, I have it. I don't know how many of you ever saw the movie The Paper. Anybody? Okay. Not The Paper Chase. This was a Ronnie Howard movie. It was basically about a New York tabloid. But if you've ever, it's a little cartoonish to say the least, but if you ever get a chance to see it on cable or anything like that, it's all about, today, what do we have today? How can we beat the other guy? The truth is, the public often, it's a little misplaced. The public really tell us, and in surveys and other ways, and I believe this, that they don't care who breaks these stories. Matter of fact, they don't remember who breaks the story. Only journalists know that, the Globe got the story one day before the Times. None of the public ever remembers that. What they want fundamentally is accuracy. But there is such an internal drive within the DNA of a newsroom to get something first that it creates decisions that are made in haste and that are made without going through. I'm going to give you an example of something. Okay. It follows along these lines a little bit. Since we're on the Lewinsky-Clinton thing, I'll give it to you this way. People will not forget this, but after the impeachment process with President Clinton, after he was acquitted in the Senate, he was actually impeached, which is what the House of Representatives did, but he didn't lose his office because he was acquitted in the Senate. They did not convict him in the Senate, so he stayed as president. Shortly after that, there was a story that started percolating in the journalistic world that a woman back years earlier in Arkansas named Juanita Broderick, had accused Clinton of not having an affair with her, but sexually assaulting her, a crime, okay? Now, this came right on the heels of a year-long ordeal in which the country no longer wanted to hear anything about Clinton and his personal life. In a couple of different places, it became known that NBC was working on this story and had gone down and interviewed this woman. But they had not aired the piece. And again, in certain places, might have been the Drudge Report and elsewhere, there were little mentions of how come the Juanita Broderick story is being buried? How come the Juanita Broderick, this is very serious business. So the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal sent one of their own writers down there. Now, to say something about the Wall Street Journal, I know you guys are probably not crazy media hounds, but since you're asking about this stuff, I'll tell you. The Wall Street Journal has one of the most conservative editorial pages in the country, and they were on a, whether deserved or not, on a full-fledged jihad against Bill Clinton. I mean, as far as the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal was concerned, Bill Clinton did everything but sink the Titanic. He was guilty of almost every crime that had ever been done from the beginning of day one. They were merciless, day in, day out. When this Juanita Broderick story started percolating, and when NBC did not air the interview with the woman, they sent one of their own reporters, one of their own editorial page writers, a woman named Dorothy Rabinowitz, down to interview her and write the story. And so the real story in the mainstream media of Juanita Broderick's incredibly potent allegations of essentially a felony against Bill Clinton broke in the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. There's something a little funky about that. I mean, this is a news story, right? This is not a, we think Clinton ought to resign for malfeasance. I mean, the editorial pages are about opinion. They don't usually break, sometimes occasionally they do, but stories about a president being accused, although he wasn't president then, I don't believe, of sexual assault are page one stories. They're reporting stories. So what was it doing inside the paper in the editorial page? Well, I called up the managing editor. There is what they call there's a church and state line between the journal's news pages, which were very fair, very objective, just went after the news, and the journal's editorial pages, which were totally against Clinton. And the guy actually running the journal, this time, Paul Steiger, is actually the guy who runs ProPublica now. And I said, how come you didn't do this story? And he said, because we didn't think it was newsworthy. So here within your own, within the same institution, you have the news side of the operation saying, this is no story. And you have the editorial side, which hated Clinton's guts, saying, this is a big story. And therefore, they took what was traditionally something in the news side and published it there. So now, the Juanita Braga story is big. And no one knows what to make of it. Suddenly, we have this horrible allegation against the President of the United States coming right on the heels. And frankly, there was so much Clinton fatigue at this point that the country didn't really, they just didn't have the stomach. The sort of, do we have to figure out whether this happened or not, too? You know, it was just sort of too much. But, you know, everybody starts to talk about this thing. And we at the Boston Globe say, what are we going to do? You know, this story is out there. It's in the ether. Everybody's talking about it. We don't know if it's true or not. It's classic he said, she said case at this point. These are serious allegations. We have no way of proving them. What do? Do you sit it out? Do you try and investigate on your own? Or do you do this? Here's the story that ran on page one of the Boston Globe. And here's the headline. Appetite is slight for a new scandal. Media cool to Clinton's latest allegation. This guy gets it already. It is an ugly tale of sexual scandal involving Bill Clinton and a young woman. And when the major news outlet working on the story hesitated running it, cyber gossip Matt Drudge hyped the details on his politically charged website. This time, the newsmaker is an Arkansas woman named Juanita Broderick. And there is a major difference between the Monica S. Lewinsky case and Broderick's assertion that Clinton sexually assaulted her 21 years ago. While the former triggered a mainstream media frenzy, the latter seems to have landed with a dull thud, getting only sporadic play and failing to ignite a buzz on yesterday's morning news talk show. This story appeared on page one of the Boston Globe in 1999. It was, to my knowledge, the first time the paper had mentioned an unproven allegation against the same president of the United States. And it is a classic example of backing into a story. How did they tell people that Juanita Broderick, that somebody accused the president of sexual assault? Not by proving it, not by reporting it on their own, but obviously by talking about the media response or lack thereof to the one person who did the story. Just look at the story. You got it. It's not one of them. It's called backing in to a story. So sometimes a newspaper, when there was kind of an unseemly story that they weren't sure whether they liked it or it was fair or and they certainly couldn't prove it, they would have their media guy, namely me, back into the story by writing about how the rest of the media handled it. Yeah?
Isn't that getting problematic in the way to put together media sources?
Well, you mean, this story didn't really attack, it didn't really attack other media sources. It didn't say that the story was unwarranted. It fundamentally took a cuter, and I take the blame for this because I've concocted it, a cuter storyline, which is, well, how can we tell people about the story? All we can tell, and really my story was, how come, you know, people aren't paying attention to this. And it sort of got into the idea of fatigue. Let me tell you something about these kind of stories involving the private behavior, although obviously if Clinton committed a felony, and to this day we don't know, the story really never went anywhere. I mean, then that's something different than a fear. But
wasn't he just part of the Linus Brothers? Was that the...
I don't know.
It was one of the two.
I don't think it was Broderick. Maybe it was Paula Jones.
It was one of the two.
Yeah. And, and the Jones thing was obviously different. I mean, this was literally an allegation of sexual assault. I mean, I think it was rape.
The Jones thing was rape.
Well, it was it rape?
Yeah.
I guess it was.
Yeah, it was.
I'm trying to remember if that's exactly. Well, except that she does not force to commit the act, right? I can't. I have to admit, it's all hazy now. But I will say this when it comes, and for all the talk about the media, and this raises the other ethical issue I want to get into before mercifully let you guys go. For all the talk about the media expanding its domain, getting into the private life of public figures, and sort of throwing stuff out there, maybe because they think it's important, maybe because they think it'll sell newspapers, and opening up a level of sort of invasions of privacy, justified or that we've never seen before. Let me just tell you an ugly little secret about it, which goes back to the broader story. Well, I'll mention one other thing, the John Edwards story. Okay, we talked about that earlier. John Edwards is running for President of the United States. He doesn't formally announce. In the fall of 2007, everybody knows he's running for President of the United States. What do you think he is? He ran in 2004. He was actually on the vice presidential ticket that lost a very close election. The National Enquirer, yes, the supermarket tabloid. One of the great things about the supermarket tabloid, for those of you who aren't big fans, is that, you know, it's easy to mock them, and in many respects they're very mockable. And when, you know, when the Star newspaper, which is very much like the National Enquirer, was the one that broke the Jennifer Flowers story about Bill Clinton in 1992, somebody, I think it might have been Clinton or some defendant that's in the law, you know, these are places, these are magazines, these are newspapers that are led by aliens coming to land on Earth, that, you know, why should we believe that? Well, the truth is, they don't really write about aliens and you know, or Elvis meeting the Pope in a Walmart. I mean, they don't do those kinds of stories. They actually do, most of those kinds of stories are, you know, last words of Liz Taylor, which they've written that story about 852 times, or, Latoya Jackson's deep grief over Michael. She feels guilty, you know, whatever. They actually don't really do the incredibly crazy stories like Satan Escapes from Hell, which is my favorite all-time headline on one of the supermarket tabloids from the, called the Weekly Globe. And that's a story. How that's not on page one for the rest of the news, I don't know. But that's something we all need to know about if that's the case. The National Enquirer writes a story that basically says, in the fall of 2007, he had an affair outside his marriage. 2 months later, the magazine, the National Enquirer again, identified the woman and said she was pregnant. Edwards denies the affair. Most of the news media, as I can recall at that point, either ignored it or published a tiny, you know, one paragraph, you know, story today, Edwards' campaign denies. Well, we all know what happened. The Enquirer kept on the story. The mainstream media largely ignored it. As when Edwards was running for president, and after he was done, defeated early in the primaries and dropped out of the race, he admitted the affair. Now, again, we can argue till the cows come home about whether we should have known and whether that was important and whether that is a legitimate piece of information to have when you're walking into the voting booth about somebody. But the bottom line was the National Enquirer, in many respects, embarrassed the mainstream. They got the story, they got it, and they got it right. The mainstream media ignored it, and at the end of the day, what did they have to do? Then they had to treat it like a big deal. Then every TV show wanted to have Elizabeth Edwards on and do the interview. Then everyone wanted to sit down and interview John Edwards. Then it became a massive story. Well, it raises a very interesting ethical question. If a story is not worth pursuing in the first place, or it's fundamentally worth ignoring, why is it suddenly not worth ignoring when somebody else breaks it and gets it right? And, you know, does there need to be some level of ethical consistency here? If you don't think the story is important enough to pursue it on your own, if you're willing to ignore it in the beginning, are we sure that it's such a big deal when it finally does get broken and acknowledged? But in many of these cases, what actually happens with the mainstream press is they aren't very squeamish about these kinds of stories. They're not comfortable with them. When I talk to you about this desire to be first, to break the story, to get the scoop in the newsroom, in many cases, when it comes to these kinds of stories, the mainstream media really wants to be second. Like I did with the Broderick story, I don't really want to get my hands dirty with this. If there's something unseen, let somebody else do it, and then I'll pick it up. And let's look at the history. So the National Enquirer breaks the John Edwards story. They also happen to break a story about Jesse Jackson fathering a child outside of his marriage, which may or may not have been important to anybody. Bill Clinton's affair with Jennifer Flowers in 1992 was broken by the Star supermarket tabloid. The Monica Lewinsky story, as I said, was in some ways, but no other body of the mainstream media had reported yet, was broken by Matt Drudge, who would call himself essentially a gossip in cyberspace. The infidelity story that led to the resignation of incoming House Speaker Robert Livingston in 1998 was essentially the work of Larry Flint, a professional pornographer. The story about Senator Larry Craig and his arrest in a Minnesota airport, which turned out to be a pretty big deal, was broken by Roll Call, a Capitol Hill newspaper, even though the major daily newspaper in Craig's state, the Idaho Statesman, had been working on a story about Craig's sexual orientation for months but hadn't published anything. In every single one of these cases, it was not the mainstream media that broke these stories. It was the mainstream media that ended up making a huge deal out of it after somebody else did. So it's kind of like, well, you do the dirty work, and then we'll talk about it.
So what happens if you live in a scene where there isn't a National Enquirer, and you're the only one, you're the only community or ethnic, I don't know, whatever.
Well, obviously by definition, the National Enquirer, you know, obviously everybody could hear about it, but your question is well put, because what it really means is, sure, national stories, big stories, stories involving public figures that everybody knows about, even if the mainstream media are squeamish about it, maybe rightfully so, are going to get broken somewhere and somehow everybody's going to find out about it. But what about in your hometown? What about in your local community? What about if there, and obviously not every scandal in any stretch of the imagination is about marital fidelity. What if it's, you know, frankly, what if it's about, you know, corruption? What if it's about dereliction of duty? What if it's about patronage and nepotism run amok, you know? And the truth is, if you're in that kind of a community, in a smaller community, and there's one or two media outlets in your town, and that's it, and they don't have a strong investigative bent, you're going to be in trouble. You're not going to find these kinds of things out in most cases. And that's a real...
Your obligation to investigate is that much more of a responsibility.
No one else is going to do it. And so the onus on you to certainly think about it and decide what's at stake somebody else is going to come in and do the job for you. That's exactly right. I will tell you, to a certain degree, we did a study at the Project for Excellence in Journalism about what has happened to the journalists who are assigned to Washington, D.C. And in the last 10 years in particular, but even the last 20 years, the number of newspapers that have assigned their own reporters to cover Washington, D.C., and particularly local or regional newspapers, has dramatically decreased. Now, as it turns out, there's as many reporters in Washington, D.C. as ever. But essentially, it's from niche publications that are business-oriented or trade-oriented that are eventually producing information for insiders, lobbyists, or other interests who need to know what's going on. So that's not for the regular citizen. Or the foreign media, which has gotten much, much... I mean, the Al Jazeera Bureau in Washington alone is massive now. But the problem is, as resources have been drained off of good old-fashioned, local community papers, the chance that, you're going to find out what your congressman is up to have been dramatically reduced. And that's a real problem. Yeah.
Well, isn't there also a responsibility on more regional papers to have local coverage, perhaps even specific to that region, thinking when it comes to the Globe?
Okay.
I don't know what it's called now, but about the kids, it's like the Less Weekly.
So yeah, which is all, by the way, that's no longer, and they just killed that.
Okay.
Yeah, they killed the Weekly's own edition in one of their most recent cost-cutting.
How long ago was that?
I'd say within the past 4, 5, 6 months. Yeah. Go ahead.
It's the thing that one of the things that I noticed was a lot of local stories, from a very small town in Massachusetts.
Sure.
A lot of our local stories got covered just as well, if not better, Less Week. We actually was a very good check on the local papers.
What can I ask for community? Okay. Do you have a Community Weekly?
Yeah.
The Stone Villager was bought out by the Mayor Beacon,
so
the Stone Villager was still in there. Sure. And they weren't very good, is what you're saying.
They weren't always very good.
Okay, yeah. And
Less Weekly
often... Well, I started out in weekly journalism. Yeah. I actually started out at a newspaper called The Tab, which was started out in Brookline and Newton, and then expanded mightily, and then was ended up being sold to Fidelity Investments, and now who knows what it is. But... you know, community grassroots journalism is a great thing when it's done, and we, I'll tell you one funny story about this. You know, I'm a big fan of community journalism and local journalism, and I thought, you know, I mean, I started a paper that started in Newton and Brookline, and, you know, my first thought was, wow, there's a Brookline, you know, full of doctors and politicians and powerful people. They're not going to read my little stinky articles about, you know, traffic mitigation on, you know, Galen Road or anything like that, you know. But the truth is they did, you know. And you found out the value of, you know, learning about what was happening in your school system, on your street. The problem with those newspapers, in many respects, was, and I can say, I started working for one, now this is a long time ago, several decades, for the princely sum of $135 a week. And they obviously were places where young journalists went to learn and then move up, and they didn't pay well enough to sustain young journalists. Whereas if you had the Globe, or a paper like the Globe, using its younger but now much more seasoned journalists would come from those kind of feeders, you were going to get a higher quality of journalism in most cases.
And then you also have to see that Fidelity basically bought out almost every local newspaper and in Massachusetts.
That's correct. And they subsequently sold that to Pat Purcell, who's the owner of the Herald, who subsequently sold to a place called King House, and they're now fundamentally bankrupt. So all of those community papers are probably going to go down the toilet. I'm going to say one, I do want to say one interesting thing about community journalism. There's a little off point, and I'm sorry about that, but then I'll ask. When I was at the Tab in Brookline, we were a terrific paper, and we did a really sophisticated job of covering local journalism. You know, the aldermen. I mean, we were not simply one of these local communicators that said, okay, the Garden Club meets next Tuesday. Here's the score of the high school baseball game. You know, we actually had pretty sophisticated analytical interpretive journalism, and we were always looking to get that one investigative scoop. You know, we just wanted to break one big investigative story. And we actually worked with a bunch of interesting people. We were all in our early 20s. One ended up in the New York Times. One of them ended up in 60 Minutes. You know, so we always felt like we could do better. We could do something bigger. And then we finally got our big chance. The local region post, you know, sort of the war veterans post, had something called video poker. And just a video poker game that people played at the bar, the older guys, when they were drinking. And we sent our undercover reporter, who was, you know, probably had about 2 years experience in journalism, into the Legion Post one day. And he found out, lo and behold, that illegally, they were paying off on the video poker machine. It was supposed to be completely recreational. Gambling itself, any exchange of money was completely prohibited. And we said, we got it. This is it. This is a big community journalism scoop. There's illegal gambling going on at the VFW post or the Legion post or whatever. And so we sent our investigators, ace investigative boy, this kid did end up at 60 Minutes, so he actually had this in his blood a little bit, into there. He went undercover. He played. He took notes. He saw money changing hands and all this kind of stuff. We looked at the statutes. We said, oh, we finally got a sexy investigative story. We called City Hall for comment and basically said, do you know this is going on? And, of course, they did, but they couldn't tell us. So what they said, well, we'll go down there and stop it. What they, I think, fundamentally did was they called the Post and basically warned them and said, you know, put that stuff away. We don't want to have anything to do with this, but stop doing this. When we wrote our big investigative scoop, we were popular. Our newspaper, people liked it. You know, the people in the community really liked it. They responded to it positively. When we finally had our splashy page one, illegal gambling, licensing bureau to investigate, the community turned again. They hated it because basically those guys at the Post were nice guys. Everybody knew them in the community. No one cared if they were spending a few bucks there. For the first time in our lives, instead of we being looked at as kind of, you know, nice young kids reporting on the community, doing their job, we were like these pushy investigative reporters who were like, you know, being unfair to good guys in the community. Even the two guys at the sub shop where we ate every day, who were the two old, sweetest old men in Newton, you know, start grumbling at us when we ordered our subs for like the next 2 months. I mean, they were like, take it, you know. I learned a valuable lesson that sometimes, you know, you really, there are such things as community standards. And, you know, you can violate them in your journalistic zeal. And the one time we had decided that we were going to get all undercovery and, you know, Woodward, Bernstein, and everybody hated us. Yes, Rabbi.
Yes, I wanted to put in a second round point. Two things I wanted to one is, again, I wrote about yesterday here in the comedy road on the journal theater, some of his perspective suggested that he felt that there was a duty to confront the person accused with the evidence before you publish. And if they resign, the owner may sue for both. Because his job is to make sure you can't depend on their story.
Wow.
And then you should always give them the opportunity to choose to back away. The whole public interest is only so long as the public interest corporation has a right to choose to keep your privacy. And the second question I think is related is also the third governor of religion. Well, that does these local cities, the Brooklyn Fed found that finds out there's older than having an affair.
Right.
So on a scale, it's the same issue as the Washington Post finding out that the senator is having an affair. But I think everyone
would
put it down the table.
Correct. Unless there was some... Yeah, there, the bar would have to be much higher.
If you're attracted to having an affair,
right,
it's not used in
the
local
paper. I totally agree with that. Unless they happen to be running as a family values select. I would totally agree with that. The bar for publishing that kind of story would have to be higher. And let me say, infinitely higher. First, here's what I would say about what you just said. Certainly, before you publish anything, the target, the subject of your story, has to be confronted with the information that you have and has to be given a chance to respond. And sometimes that means I'm not talking to you, you know, for I don't have anything to say about this, but there has to be a clear and organize effort to get to this person, to make sure this person knows exactly what you are going to publish and has every chance to respond. I will tell you, there was a famous libel suit not that long ago between the Boston Herald and a judge in Massachusetts that ended up with a $2 million libel award to the judge, which is shocking because under libel law, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, if you are for someone to have been found guilty of libeling a public figure, and a judge is certainly a public figure, not only do you have to prove that the story was wrong, not only do you have to prove that the story was defamatory, you have to prove malice, which fundamentally means that there was ill will and nasty intent all the way around. This judge won a $2 million award against the Boston Herald, and what actually happened was they made a series of allegations about him, including statements that he reportedly made showing no sensitivity to a young 14-year-old rape victim and other things like that, and other victims of crime. And their first day story, they did not get to the judge. They did not get to the judge for a comment. And the judge commented the second day. They said they went to the court list, they tried to find him, they couldn't locate him, they tried to get a message to him. They clearly did not make an overwhelming effort to get to this guy and say, this is what we're doing tomorrow, what do you have to say about it? And whether or not it played any role in a shocking $2 million verdict for the judge, I can't say, but that goes without saying. I would personally disagree with the second component of his ethics there. Now, it depends what the... I mean, you can't say categorically that every story, you know, if you go to so-and-so and say, we've got to sign you and they resign, I mean, it depends what it is, to some degree, about whether or not you think it's newsworthy. You know, I mean, if it's a story that says, hey, you know, we found out I don't know what it is, you're walking around your office, you know, wearing women's clothing, and if you're a man or something like that, and then you resign the next day. I mean, you might argue about whether or not that's a story worth publishing, but most of the time, the service, journalism, ideally, is not supposed to be outcome-oriented. In my opinion, the real ethical core of journalism is, the real thought is to tell the truth, is to find out the truth of the situation and give that truth to the public. In theory, in its most highest idealized form, journalism is about creating intelligent, informed citizens who are given the kind of information that lets them make good choices, whatever they might be, as citizens. It is not about, among other things, making sure that somebody loses their job or making sure that somebody else wins an election. I mean, obviously the biggest prize in the world, the Pulitzer Prizes, in investigative journalism and otherwise, go to stories that do have a chain reaction, that lead to reform, that lead to resignation, that lead to jail terms. But it's not, the real job of journalism is to inform the public, it's not to create an outcome. So I would argue that in most cases I can think of, if a story is significant enough to confront somebody about it, and they then take themselves out of harm's way, the public good is not simply served by getting rid of that public servant or having the problem dealt with. Public good is served in telling the story, because often in the telling of the story there is some lesson about why something happened that may be a systemic failure, an institutional failure, that the public needs to know about. And that would be my argument.
I'm always going to say that, though.
What's that?
Let's say Jerry Hart.
Okay.
Jerry Hart, right? Jerry, the front of the bar, right? And you know what? You're right. I blew it. I'm going to have it.
Okay, but realistically, if Gary Hart one day goes from the front runner in a presidential race and the next day he's gone, how is he not going to be, how can he keep the circumstances of why he's gone a secret?
I had it like this year, in a professional situation.
Okay.
Where quite astoundingly, it seems like a secret about departure has been fully kept.
Does the media knew about or not? Well, organizations have their own dynamics. I mean, they will, certainly most organizations or institutions would rather clean up their own dirty laundry and not have a peep about it. In many cases, that happens. I mean, much of that does happen far away from the public life. But if a media organization, presumably, is going after a story that involves somebody because that person's job, life, responsibilities impact other people. It would be fully impossible for Gary Hart to take the podium one day and go, I'm leaving the race, and the media not be able to figure out if we're elicit an answer unless he then chose to lie about why he was leaving the race.
I was going to say, what's the ethics of the media? You're a reporter.
Yeah.
Aaron says, don't get down to the situation, but I feel like I can no longer continue in the race. And I ask the media to take money on family privacy. And of course, some reporters know that.
Right.
But what's the ethical justification for continuing to publish a story about the address?
If he takes the podium and says, this is a family situation, and I'm asking for the respect of the media, and leaving. I would say this. I don't think that he's earned the right to privacy in that case, from my own perspective. And I would say this is, now, if a selectman says it, and I'm a local reporter, then I might say, okay. But this man was running for the highest office in the land. This man was running to be the most powerful person in the world. This man had done very well. He had a lot of supporters. He had more supporters than anybody else in the Democratic Party. I think the public there deserves an explanation. And I would also say that my own sense would be that I always talk about the Gary Hart story, frankly, that it was different than some of the other infidelity issues. To me, I mean, just off the top of my head, I will tell you that there are certain cases when infidelity issues or family issues do rise, but when it's clear that there seems to be more of a legitimate public interest than others. One, in my book, is hypocrisy. If someone's private behavior is at odds with their public life, then to my way of thinking, that justifies media scrutiny. If somebody, as tragic as it may be, if somebody has spent their entire life voting for anti-gay legislation, the Defense of Marriage Act, and runs campaigns, in which family values and gay rights are an issue, and then turns out to be a closeted gay person, in my opinion, that's going to rise to a level of legitimate interest in the part of the media more than other stories would. And in the Gary Hart case, I actually felt about that knowing what happened to him was legitimate for the American public, because first and foremost, like many politicians, there might be a second act. He might come back 4 years later or 6 years later or run for something else and do something else. And my own personal impression was, because this issue had been floated out there, because Gary Hart was someone who spent much of his adult life preparing for the presidency, because he in effect had been warned, it was this flashing red light, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, and he had done it. To me, there was something about Gary Hart that was manifest in that behavior that went far beyond the question of do I deserve to know whether he's faithful to his wife or not, and said something to me as a news consumer. Somebody said to me, do I want to know about it? Yes. Because there's something now about Gary Hart, a man who essentially has his finger on the button, a man who would be the most powerful man, and there's something about his character that I feel this story illustrates that I want to know about. But it's, yes. So, you first, yes.
You draw a line that, I don't think that person has earned the right to privacy.
Right.
What is that supposed to mean?
I mean,
that's predicated on the assumption that once someone has walked into the public sphere, for some reason he's forfeited his right to privacy in the media, no matter what he'll ever do.
Oh, no, no. I just said in this case, in that...
How did he forfeit his right to privacy? He's no longer doing anything to the public. And presumably, the right to privacy...
I would say the right to privacy, and this has something to do with a lot of laws, a man going about his business as a private citizen who is known to his family and his immediate surroundings and the people around him, the people who work with him, who may get involved in a situation that's embarrassing, to me, is not the same as a man who is taking a campaign to 200 million Americans, who is talking to them every day. What's that? After he's done all. And he stepped out because of some reason of his own doing. I mean, to me, someone who has lived a life in the public sphere, who has asked for the support of the American people, who has touted his ideals, his views, his life, and everything else as a reason to bestow upon him power, power to influence the life of every American, there's a much lower bar to the quote-unquote privacy. You don't get privacy automatically because you say, well, yesterday I wanted to be President of the United States, and today I want to go away.
And you theoretically,
Sure.
And you really would step out of public life and all, any way you're involved. I don't know if you know that.
Of course, there'd be no way.
But, maybe he actually, at the same time, he actually went to contract, terminal illness, let's say, and he never actually, and he would have stepped out anyway, for practical reasons. But at that moment, something else convinces you that he will never be a public figure. So then what? I mean, he actually has 3 years to live now.
Okay.
Now what? Because he was public, he lost
the
right
to
privacy. He will never be a public figure. It's impossible.
So let me just unravel this a little bit. So he's a guy who's running for president. He actually stopped running for president because of an affair, and we know he's got terminal
illness. No, at that same moment when you're about to break that story, he finds out he has terminal illness. And he would have stepped out anyway. So the fact that you break the story has actually no...
I think we're now living in a slight world of unreality, which is I just don't think. Well, I think that somebody who's running for president, my sense, it's not, as I said before, journalism is outcome based. It's not the idea of writing the Gary Hart had an affair story isn't to make sure that he doesn't ever run for public office again. If that's the outcome of the journalism, that's okay. But the journalist's job is not to say, my job is done when this guy's in jail, or my job is done when this guy never shakes another voter's hand in his life. The journalistic idea is, I need to tell the American public the truth about important matters. Now, the debate is the important matter. And is this important to you? And frankly, if somebody is no longer going to be president of the United States or no longer going to ask your vote, you could certainly, you would argue, obviously, that if somebody said I'm getting out, that the affair would be perhaps less important than somebody said I'm not getting out, right? That I would agree with that. But it's not simply, okay, we achieved what we wanted to achieve, and therefore the story dies because we've gotten the outcome. The question is, that every user of this has to balance is, does the American public have a right to know about this? And I would argue that when you are talking about an individual running for the highest office in the land who has made themselves the ultimate public figure and whose every pronouncement, whose every policy statement, whose every comment on the issues of the day is meant for widespread public dissemination, there's not a big zone of privacy around them, even regard with forgetting what the outcome of their political career might be. Yeah.
Certainly now there's sort of it depends what you're finding out. I mean, the Sally Hemings thing with Thomas Jefferson, it's not like somehow something bad is going to happen to Jefferson. So, depending on what we find out about him now. I mean, Kennedy's a pretty good example because here's a president who was much beloved, who was sort of, obviously wasn't president for long, was very popular, was lionized in his time. And obviously, you guys are way too young. Your parents might be able to tell you about him. Was seen as this sort of bright breath of fresh air, was martyred, and who sort of lived in history as this sort of idealized figure. And since that happened, there has been a steady stream of stories, one more salacious than the other, about his personal life. And in many cases, now, I'm not saying that I think the idea that, I would say in that case that most of those stories I think are irrelevant. And most of those stories, because he died, because it's not clear that it had any impact on public policy, and that frankly, in some ways, there's a contest to see who can come up with the raziest version of it. And it's happened so long after his death. I mean, you can always argue that there's go ahead.
The governor of Massachusetts
were to
die today.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure there would be some people who wouldn't be, but anyway, that's not nice to say. Okay.
Okay. He was
10 years
past
Okay.
There are all sorts of, then all of a sudden, there's a whole set of possible scandals they could hear about him. What sorts of things would you consider to be legitimate things to report about him after his death,
Broadly speaking, certainly anything that involved his actions in office.
And what about his personal life?
My own sense about if he passed away today and tomorrow we found out he had a 10-year affair with somebody and there was no link to we could find no link to misuse of public funds or any impact on his personal behavior, I wouldn't be interested. Then as a journalist and a media organization, you are faced with the, what do we do about it now? And, the argument so many times is, we have to cover, everybody's talking about it. We have to cover it. The truth is, if you don't cover it, so what? It's not like, you can't stop it. I mean, all you can say is I didn't cover it, which, is in some ways, scant consolation, because you haven't stopped the story. You've made a statement about your own values and beliefs, which is laudable, but it's not like in any way, shape, or form that, you've managed to impact the story or kept a significant amount of people from finding out about it, particularly today's world. All you can do is stand up for your own values. And it can be, the Edwards thing is a classic case. Here are people really, clearly, nobody wants to follow the National Enquirer. When they break a story, everyone wants to leave it alone. And then at the end of the day, it becomes a giant story that they all decide is important. And now, and so in journalism circles, the argument, the real the theme has been, and the sort of the buy-in from the takeaway from the whole episode has been, the mainstream media was asleep. They were beaten and they did not do their job. And that's sort of where that argument lies right now in journalism.
I think you take two more questions.
Okay. Sure. Yeah.
Journalistically is situations change. Let's face it, circumstances change, and they should and can impact your ethics. I mean, the first case that I gave you guys is a good example. Certainly, I would support in general the idea that you don't name the race of a suspect when that's all you have. And I thought that the globe was well intentioned in that story. But in my personal opinion, the one that I offered as ombudsman, they made a mistake in that particular case by not mentioning what she said with her dying words on the floor of her grocery store because of different and new circumstances. And my sense is, my own feeling is, you know, journalistic ethics, can't simply be etched in stone and never, you know, in any way, shape, or form have any flexibility. They can be responded to in the context of changing circumstances, and changing circumstances can make you make different ethical decisions. They are still ethical, but the problem is when the circumstances change. In my book, are you still going through the process, or are you now being driven by something else? If you say, Reggie Lewis, you know, okay, we didn't have enough to link him to drugs when he died. Now the Wall Street Journal has this. Let's go back and get it. And then you go out and you collect a lot of material. And you sit down and say, okay, this is what we found. What do we think now? And if you still go through that same basic ethical thinking values, given the change, the changed circumstances, thinking values, and yes, there's a justification for doing it. Even if that justification somebody else did it on some level, but it now still comports basically, that's okay. I mean, that's a legitimate process. If, in fact, what really happens is you're just compelled to almost unconsciously or subconsciously change your standards because your frame has changed and you don't ever have that conversation again. You just sort of, the story just gets in the paper because now there's a new sort of situation no one's really even talking about. That to me is a problem. So yeah, I think as long as you sort of still go through that process, you can factor in changed circumstances. It's when the changed circumstances sort of prove to be their own dynamic
that I would argue the journalist gets in trouble.
Sure.
So I'm really intrigued by this idea of not being end-focused. But I'm still curious if you can help me understand or articulate.
Probably not, but go ahead.
If there's always a lesson to learn about why things happened the way they did,
sure,
or whatever. So in the Gary Hart story,
yeah,
what is the lesson for us to learn here?
What I took away from the Gary Hart story, honestly, as a news consumer, why I would have been very uncomfortable with this man being president of the United States. Not that I cared, and that I didn't personally, I didn't feel that way about Bill Clinton. I mean, I think Bill Clinton had his own problems, but I didn't react the same way necessarily to his affair with Jennifer Flowers as I did with Gary Hart. In Gary Hart's circumstances, my lesson as a news consumer, and I was glad the story broke, was there's something wrong with this guy. You know, there is something deeper than the issue of whether he should or is faithful to his wife. something about him that makes me very uncomfortable with making him president of the United States. And in my own mind, I could be wrong. It was either that he was this story in my book proves that he's incredibly reckless. By the way, the Donna Wright thing, you know, it wasn't simply the Miami Herald that then had the story. I mean, a lot of other stuff came out, including a picture of her sitting on his lap on a boat called the Monkey Business, of all things. you can't make this stuff up. My own feeling about whether a man or a woman is faithful to his or her spouse, whether that disqualifies them for office, I evaluate case by case. I mean, I'm not one of those. That's it. You know, I don't want some sinner being president. Or I wouldn't vote for him. But in my book, what I took away from that one is, I'm glad somebody let me know about this, because what happened here was, here was a man with a dream. Here was a man who was coming close to achieving a dream. Here was a dream that would have involved and affected my life and the life of every other American. Here was a man being essentially, I mean, I'm pointing crudely, but being warned about an obstacle that was in the way of his dream. Here was a man being told that people were looking at something that might be in the way of his dream. And here was a man who basically flaunted all that and threw it away in the most obvious way. And to me, that said, my own interpretation, he's either incredibly reckless or he's got some self-destructive impulse, neither of which I want at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, that was just me. I would not expect, I think a lot of people might have said, I don't care about the story, or might have evaluated them differently. But that was my lesson in that one.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Question. I didn't want to ask you before because I don't think anyone else cares about this issue. Like, I was 10 years old when I grew up inside, and this was for me, I grew up in Lafayette, and this was part of the formative moments for me in reading newspapers.
Yeah.
Was like following this story. In my house, you know, the Boston Celtics was probably the most important thing.
I guess. That's pretty significant.
I mean,
I guess.
That's how my father treated it. That's how, you know, it was a big, like, where were you when you heard about it? I mean, this is a little bit of a joke, but it's,